Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1051. The Wizard Guitar Tour is underway in various cities like Brea, California. That's just one night on Saturday, March 21st. And then the weekend after, the 26th, 27th, 28th, I'll be at Helium in Portland. And then I'll be at the Wilbur Theater in Boston, April 3rd. The tickets and info for all of the dates, which are populating the calendar throughout the rest of 2020, are at wizardguitar.com. Come on out and see the Wizard Guitar. But now, oh, and also The Wall, the NBC game show The Wall starts back March 15th, which is real soon. And there's a bunch of episodes. And the show, we taped a little while ago, but damn, people really figured out how to play the game, and it is incredible. So if you are a fan of The Wall, it is coming back on Sunday nights, I think at like 7 p.m. on March 15th for a while. And if you're not a fan of The Wall, that's fine too. There are a lot of entertainment choices out there. I don't know how we keep up with everything, quite honestly. There's just... I don't want to say there's too much entertainment, but there's a lot. In any case, let's talk about you. We're going to talk about Cameron Chiles, who has emailed events at ID10T.com, who said, I made a thing. It is the pilot episode of Turbo City Gaiden, an animated series chronicling the adventures of the baddest band on the planet, the Mad Gear. Aesthetically, the series takes its cues from the 8 and 16-bit video games. The art is pixelated, the animation is simple, and the music is chipified. The show itself is inspired by countless video games, Saturday morning cartoons, film noir, and The Warriors. It also has been described as Streets of Rage meets Strong Bad. Now that the pilot is out, we're launching a Kickstarter to make a full season. You can find it all at madgearband.com. Thank you, Cameron. Thank you for making a thing. This episode is Russell Peters, stand-up comedian Russell Peters, who I don't think actually has ever been on the podcast before. He was on At Midnight. I don't think he's actually ever been on the podcast. So this might be his premiere episode. He's promoting his new Amazon stand-up special, Deported, which, as I just said, is on Amazon. But I said it really fast. I kind of barreled through it. So I'm just going to say it again. It is on Amazon. Russell Peters, thank you so much for being on this episode of the ID10T podcast, which starts right now.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
No babies yet.
I won't do it.
It's so funny because and I imagine you too, because this is just sort of what happens as comedians get older. They just sort of talk about stuff in their life. I've started talking about the potential of having kids in my show, and it's always so funny how divided it is. Some people are like, it's the best, and other people are like, don't do it. So it just...
just people that are telling it's the best are just, you know, that misery loves company, right?
I know, it is always like a weird club that people are trying to recruit you for, like, when are you gonna do it? And like, hey, come on,
don't do it,
it's your culty club. I don't know, I
you can't go back from it. That's the thing. It's not like...
There's no backtracking.
Like a bad haircut? I'll grow out.
Oh. It's like the tire spikes that go up. Like, you get tired,
yeah,
you can't back up.
Yep.
You can't back up. That's it.
Yeah, children are tire spikes.
I think that's the takeaway from today.
That's why they say you're so tired.
Oh, we did it.
We did,
guys, we did it.
I start with a pun.
Listen, you are not going to get... I'm not going to turn my nose up at a pun.
I'm a big fan.
I am, like, puns, I feel like everyone loves them, even though some people are like, oh, you know, they're puns. But everyone loves puns.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. And I'm a father.
So you have to.
Yeah.
Kids love the wordplay. I've been excited to talk to you because you do something that is very difficult to do, which is you're able to shoot riffing in your shows.
Right.
I've always thought, like, oh, it's really... I tried to do a segment of it in my last special, and it was like an extra,
right,
where I kind of went into the crowd. But I always find that
it works in a live show because everyone's there. Mm-hmm. Shooting comedy creates a layer of separation, so right. the audience at home isn't caught up in the energy. So, like, well, I don't give a fuck, you know, like, I'm not there. So I would love to sort of talk about how you're able to make that work and how you're able to weave it in, mainly because it's something that I would really wish I could
see. I love talking to the crowd.
So do I.
Because I get bored. Like, after you, you know, when you're, when I, especially when you go to shoot a special,
mm-hmm.
you got to figure you've toured that for 2 years or something.
Yeah.
And now you're just deathly fucking bored of the act. And you're like, maybe I can, if I talk to somebody, it'll make me want to breathe new life into the material that I'm right. trying to do. So
right.
But that's also the way I write, is by talking to the crowd.
Yep.
You seem like a very structured, intelligent guy.
I write – well, that is – you've definitely been tricked.
And by intelligent, I don't mean you're smart.
Right. I just mean I overthink things.
Yeah.
It was my last two specials, I very much wrote the way that you do. And a lot of it had to do with just my schedule being so crazy
right.
that I would sort of get an idea and then just kind of riff with the crowd, see how it unfolds, or talk to people and something would come out and then it would become a part of the act. In this special, I sit down every morning at breakfast and I just write for like an hour. I tweak,
I play
with.
How do you do that? That's the part I don't understand. Like, you open your laptop or do you use pen and paper?
I open my laptop. I use a couple of different programs, a couple of different apps that I use. And I just tweak. You know, like, I listen to sets and I go, that was fat. I can cut that out. You know, like, what's a different joke on this? What's a different angle on this? So it's just tweaking every day, just incrementally, and trying at different shows, which also keeps it fresh every time.
Right. I used to, I think in the 90s, I would record my sets.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would listen to them once, only once. So here's the thing. I used to DJ.
Yeah.
I still do. I started DJing in 85. And I found through DJing that if you make a mistake in a mixtape,
mm-hmm.
when I'd be making mixtapes, if there was a mistake, like I dropped the record in at the wrong time mm-hmm. or the mix went off a little bit. And if I listen to it more than twice, in my brain goes, that's the way that's going to go. That's the way it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
So I took that and instituted it into comedy. And I would listen to my set once and I'd make my notes back then. I'm like, okay, I didn't like that. I didn't like that. And then I would not listen to that set ever again. Then I would record the next set and try to fix it. And then listen to that set once. And that's how I would kept moving it forward, because then you don't end up making the same mistakes.
No, but sometimes, especially with like DJ, if you dropped a record the wrong time, there's that Prince thing of like, if you make a mistake, do it again, because then it seems intentional, you know? Like,
yeah.
Sometimes the happy mistakes are like, and that's what I love about riffing with people, is that when things kind of go sideways, that's kind of where some of the magic happens.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can't – I don't believe – like, I can't write something verbatim and recite a script. I can write beats. Like, I'll write the joke beats, and then however it comes out is how it comes out.
Right.
Because I feel like you have to be in the relationship with the audience for that to come.
You're not married to the words.
Not at all.
Right.
That it comes out different every – you know, like – and also, I would imagine for you too, if people saw two of your shows back to back – what they would see are two different shows.
Yes.
Even though some of the core material is the same, they would have two different experiences based on your interaction with the crowd.
Right, and that's how I like to do it.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, after 31 years, I still have a nice, thriving live business.
Yeah.
Because they come out and they're like, we saw him last time, and he was fantastic. And then we saw him again, and it was completely different.
Yeah.
I've had people come out three nights in a row on a weekend because they were there Friday or Thursday, and they were like, that was so good. And then they came Friday. It was a different show again.
Yeah.
So I had a different show again. I'm like,
yeah.
All right. And I'm like, was it?
Yeah.
When I don't know that I'm doing that. You're just doing it.
It's just natural.
Yeah,
it's just natural.
Just being you.
But you have the comfort level on stage that no matter how far off the map you go, you know you're going to be able to pull it back if you need to.
Yeah, I'll just ask a leading question.
Yeah. Do you ever find sometimes that it's difficult to follow your written material, like you've had like such a stellar riff with the audience
yeah.
and they're so involved, and then all of a sudden you talk about something that doesn't involve them and like, no, talk about us again.
Yeah.
That was more fun.
I've had that. I've had myself not be able to follow myself.
Yes, yes, yeah. yes, yes, yes.
It's the best and worst feeling at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, but you can always dive back into the crowd if yeah. you need to.
And then I go, I would actually address it as soon as it happens too. I'm like, well, that was the written material, which is clearly not as good as you guys.
Yeah, of course. You know. Yeah, but that, you know, that type of comedy and what you're talking about is just like being in the purest sense of the moment, in the purest present possible, which I think is sort of what makes it fun. And I don't know if it – like, it's a whole separate skill set to recite your set like a script, and I have respect for the guys that do and are able to have it sound fresh every single right. time. But I'm like you. I have to trick myself
into – It's like jazz.
I guess so.
You know what song you're – starting to play.
and eventually you're like, I'm in this key, yeah. and I'll probably end up on this, and yeah. I just have to get there.
I'll start with the song, and I'll end with the song, but in the middle it's going to get a little convoluted.
Yeah. Do you ever go on stage and just say, like, with like, how broad are your topics when you go on stage and you don't know how it's going to work out? You go like, oh, I'm just going to talk about my kids and see what happens.
Yeah, I've had it happen a lot. I find... whenever I get to my kids, it just falls flat nowadays.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, because I'm like, eh. I get bored of it because I think about it from the perspective of when I didn't have kids and I would hear a comic talk about their kids. I'm like, I don't care about your fucking kids.
Is it dude. Just like showing someone your pictures of your kids?
Yeah, and like, oh, yeah. That's so great. Okay, get out of here. And I'm like, yeah, my kids aren't doing anything spectacular.
Right.
Like my 9-year-old is just a regular 9-year-old.
Right.
She's not an asshole. She's not, you know what I mean? She's not like wacky. She's just... quiet,
just a kid.
Yeah, and my son's 10 months old. What's he gonna do?
Not much.
Yeah. So he shit himself today, guys.
Hey guys.
Oh, yeah. Well, congratulations.
And then he ate, and then he shit yeah. himself again.
Yeah,
he might shit himself tomorrow.
Yeah, he wakes up and grabs my nose. Isn't that funny? Yeah. No.
Good night. You guys are great.
It's horrible.
You guys are great.
Yeah. So I find when I do go into it nowadays, I'm like, yeah, I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to talk about my kids anymore. It's not that I'm trying to protect them. I'm just like, you're boring.
So your career is – you have this very sort of coveted position, I think, of also having an amazing international business, which is a very tough thing to get, I think, for – at least for American comics because we're so
– I think a lot of American comics underestimate their value internationally.
Really?
Yeah. I think a lot of you guys don't realize how popular you are in other countries.
Maybe. Certainly don't.
And without tooting my own horn, which I don't like talking about myself, but – I have always been told in all these other countries that I was their first introduction to stand-up.
Oh, wow.
Like, they didn't know what it was until they saw me. And then they discovered other people.
Was it just for laughs?
No, it would have been YouTube in 2005 when it started.
Oh, my God.
Somebody put my whole act on there, and then it just went around the world.
Yeah.
And that's what made the international base really strong.
And
so, like, you go to, like, Mongolia – or you go to Malaysia, or you go to India, and you find out, what was your introduction? Oh, Russell Peters.
Yeah.
In some countries, they didn't know what it was called. They just called it what that guy did.
Yeah, and basically, it's not like you have to get – it's not like you have to go to India and get a billion people to come out. It's just like – it's
a you can get 0.1, you're good.
Yeah, exactly, exactly, yeah. exactly. And you still can have a healthy touring business. So do you – when you go to different countries, do you tour the countries themselves, or do you kind of go to like one hub city and then like everyone comes out to there?
Yeah, you go to the majors, mm-hmm. you know, and then – and then as it starts to spread, you know, like I would go to Stockholm originally.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would end up going to Malmo the next time. So you'd go Stockholm and Malmo. And then you're like, oh, Norway's right there. So let's go over to Norway. And then you start spreading out. It's just a natural spread.
It is interesting because I forget – like I have a couple of friends who are Norwegian.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them just happens to be obsessed with stand-up comedy. Like knows, you know, loves Stephen Wright and Hedberg right. and all these like – and he said, look, you know, in Norway, we got a lot of Western – we got a lot of American stuff. And he said – and I go, well, what's comedy like in Norway? And he goes, well, we're coming around to it. Like there are comedians now, but it seems like if you had the time and the focus, which you have done, of going around to countries, there's probably a lot of underserviced stand-up countries where you could like – if even just showing up, even if they didn't know who you were, they'd be like, oh, I'm going to go see this because it's a thing I haven't really seen
yeah.
before. And then I imagine they are very loyal to you because, like you said, they're the first person you saw.
Yeah, they're great to me. I have no complaints about it at all.
Do you have to – does your set change for
Not necessarily, no. I mean, you might – it's like doing the road here. You'll talk about whatever you saw in their town.
Right.
You know? You write one joke for them.
Right.
And then you do your act.
But is comedy pretty much a common denominator language in the sense that, like – every culture likes having stuff pointed out about it. Like, do they take it differently in each place, or is it pretty much the same basic thing?
Well, here's the thing is that everybody does the – ultimately, we all do the exact same things. It doesn't matter what country you're from or what color you are or whether you're male or female. It doesn't matter. We all do the exact same things. But we're so narcissistic, we think that we're the only ones doing it.
Right, and someone points it out, you're like, oh my God.
Yeah, and I'm like, oh, you know, Indian people are cheap. And then, like, Russians would be like, we're cheap. And then, you know, you got the Scottish going, no, we're cheap, Jimmy. And then everybody thinks they're this.
Right.
And then my dad, blah, blah, blah. And they go, my dad. And it's like, yeah, exactly what I'm trying to tell you. We all do the exact same thing. Well, there's nothing unique about us.
Right. I mean, I remember sort of, you know, coming up in, I guess, what would have
was
been.
Was that Chubby Chris then?
That was Chubby Chris then. Right. Oh, you remember Chubby Chris. That's so nice.
It's so weird to see you like skinny.
Well, now it's been like 15 years.
I know, but it's still
that's so
thin.
Funny. Well, I had a name for that guy. I called him Peter Hardwick. Like he was drunk me.
Hey, Peter.
But it was, it's so funny that you remember that guy. But I often, you know, like coming up in kind of the more alternative comedy scene where, you know, we'd get really snobby about club comedy.
Oh, I know.
And so.
Oh, I know all about it.
And buddy. I look back now and I feel kind of, I'm sort of annoyed with myself over it because, you know, you can say like, look, there's a comic on stage and he's fucking talking about airplane food. And it's like, yeah, but the people that came out to that show don't think about comedy 100% of the time. And maybe that's the first time someone pointed that out to them.
Yeah.
So maybe you might consider it like a topic that's, you know, like been tread on before, but maybe this person has a take on it that you haven't, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like overcoming that snobbery to realize like, hey, you know, like maybe if we're not so stuck up about stuff, we could reach people that otherwise would not understand our whole like super, you know, super ironic form of comedy that is for just people who are comedy fanatics.
We're in the uber subgenre.
Sub.
Yeah, we're living in this uber subgenre world now. And,
yeah.
You know, I always liken it to music and you can watch. I like how, you know, in the early 1900s, everybody listened to one style of music.
Yeah, exactly. And do you like music? I sure do.
Yeah. Here's some. And then you go to the 40s, and then, like, the big band stuff started. Like, ooh, we're into big band.
Yeah.
And then rock and roll started, and that's where that started to divide. Oh, you like rock and roll? We're into big band.
Right.
Oh, yeah, we like jazz. And then rock and roll came in, and then rock and roll splintered into heavy metal, glam rock, soft rock, class, you know.
Yeah.
And then disco started, and then...
Then rap becomes
and then
like
rap,
hip-hop.
And then hip-hop. And then hip-hop started subgenres.
Yeah.
Everything started to splinter and everybody started to find a niche. And that's what comedy did. Comedy, if you look at comedy from the 70s onwards, you know, it was like wacky, goofy. Then, oh, this guy swears. Oh, hold on now. It's getting darker. Hold on a second. What's that all about?
Yeah.
And then black comedy, white comedy. What's this? And stoner comedy. And then it just started to splinter again.
Yeah. Oh, Richard Pryor, you can just tell stories about your life in an honest and authentic way. That's crazy. It doesn't have to be like super jokey. You have Steve Martin. It can be super. Yeah.
Steve Martin was like extra goofy and wacky.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious to me.
He was my guy growing up.
I love Steve Martin. I loved Steve Martin. I loved Cheech and Chong.
Yeah.
I remember listening to somebody brought the 45 to school of Sister Mary Elephant.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that sketch?
No.
It was like that's how brilliant Cheech and Chong was, that they made a sketch that you had to listen to. There was no film or video of Sister Mary Elephant.
Yeah.
And it was a sketch. It was a 2-minute and 30-second sketch on a 45.
Wow.
And we would listen to it in class, and I remember crying, literally crying. Couldn't breathe laughing listening to this thing.
And that was also now we're getting into old guy talk, but that was also a period of time where you would listen to the same bit or album over and over and over. And now, you know, we've become such a consumer culture that it's like you watch or listen to – like there was a time where –
I saw it already.
Yeah, I saw it once. Yeah. Where like specials – you know, used to be really special because you would listen to it over and over again. And now it's sort of like a marker of the stand-up that you've done for the past year or two and you're about to start over. And it definitely helps. And you have a special on Amazon. But
I don't know how special it is.
But people – in general, people watch it once and they're just like, more, more, more. You know, like there's so many
things.
They're either
more or they're like, meh, meh, more or meh. Those are the check boxes.
Yeah, my friend pointed out that, you know, it's like, yeah, in the early days of film, You could just film a horse walking up a staircase because no one had done that before. Yeah. That was like mind blowing.
Yeah, look at that horse.
Oh my God, that's a moving horse up a stair. How'd they do that? You know, and then
I'm seeing a horse on the wall, and there's no horse on that wall.
And then it was like, then it had to evolve. Then they needed special effects. The horse had to be walking through space, and then it had to be all these different. You're right, the subgenres. And so, do you think it all kind of recoalesces at some point, or are we so far down the tributaries of subgenre culture that there's like no going back?
It'll eventually tie itself back together.
You think so?
It has to. You can't stray. You can't stray that far from the mother,
right.
You know, and not come back to it.
Yeah,
because eventually it's gonna. It's like stretching something. It's gonna get so thin that it doesn't matter anymore.
Right,
and it's got to come back to. To where it has some substance again.
Yeah, I mean, it blows my mind to think that on any given night, like in the 70s, that, you know, 40 million people would watch, which, you know, the population was lower back then. So that was like a real considerable chunk of this country were all watching The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
And they were watching, you know, if a comedian put out a thing, everyone saw it. And now you can still have a big thing and somehow... Not everyone knows what it is.
Look, I've had – this is my 9th special. I haven't done one talk show. I haven't done one. I don't know if I was refused.
It kind of doesn't
– It doesn't matter to me. It really doesn't. I'm like, what difference is it going to make now?
Yeah.
I think there's two shows that definitely matter to do, and that'd be – like that could – That would act like a Carson type of thing in the 70s, and that would be Howard Stern,
right?
Or maybe Joe Rogan Experience,
right?
Those are the two that people will actually pay attention to,
right? Right, right, right.
And the good news is I'm friends with Joe. Bad news is I've never done Stern.
I mean, I never have either.
No,
no.
I thought for sure you would have done it.
No, I've never done it either. But I think that's why, you know, like when all the comedians,
you should really do Rogan's podcast.
I don't know if ever he's done ours.
Yeah, really? He has?
Yeah.
That's impressive because he doesn't do anybody's.
This was a few years ago, but I think it's part of the reason why all the comedians gravitated toward podcasts is because we realize, well, there's not – people aren't doing comedy on TV much anymore.
Yeah, when I did eventually get offered like to do like Corden, they're like, they want you to do stand-up. I go, I've been doing stand-up 31 years. I'm not auditioning on TV again.
Right, right, right.
It's nothing personal. It's just like, I tell stories.
What's the 4-minute chunk? Like every piece of the set kind of relies on the context of the other pieces of the set.
Yeah, it's like, here's a piece of the Mona Lisa. Well, which piece is that? need to see the whole Mona Lisa.
Is it the hand? Is it the eye? Is it the mouth? Yeah, you need this whole thing. I completely agree with you. It's sort of hard to figure out.
It's great for new comics.
Yes.
Because they're doing 7-minute sets in the clubs.
Or 2-line joke comics.
Yeah, like
who you can just lift out two or three lines of jokes and it's super fast, high joke per minute ratio.
Yeah, it's set up for a very specific type of comic.
But the good news is that you don't need to do it. So you just keep touring.
Yeah, I mean, I don't care either way anymore.
Yeah.
It's like, eh.
Well,
it's not going to make a difference. Not going to make a dent.
I was just in Columbus and Brian Regan.
First of all, stop bragging.
Sorry, I don't mean to bring out my highfalutin words like Columbus, Ohio. But
I will be there soon.
It's a great town.
At the Punchline?
I was at the Funny Bone.
Oh, the Funny Bone.
The Funny Bone.
I'll be at the Funny Bone.
And it's in this like super high end like Grove style mall. There's like all these.
The Columbus?
Yes. I was kind of giving the crowd shit. Like,
wait, is that the one where the hotel's directly across the street?
Yeah.
Did they update that mall or something?
That mall is insane. There's like a Louis Vuitton store, a Coach store, a Burberry store. And I was asking the crowd, like, why do you guys have a Louis Vuitton store? Your median house price is $165,000. And of course they laugh. And then I would meet people afterwards and they're like, we like to spend money in Columbus, Ohio. They're just going through a period of financial
boom,
like consumerism.
Well, because everything else is so cheap.
Yeah, I guess so.
Gas is cheap. House is cheap. Cars are cheap.
But Regan came by after his show was the same night, and he came by afterwards, and we were talking. And
By the way, Regan, one of the nicest human beings on the planet.
And I love him because he doesn't get to hang out with comics at his shows because he's isolated in the theaters that he does. So he just loves to – because I saw like a week or two after my show, he was hanging out with Jackie Cation and Maria Bamford at their show. And he's just such a comics comic and a guy that – also doesn't rely on – he doesn't do talk show sets. He doesn't have to. He just – He tours. The people know they're going to see a great show, and they come back and they bring friends the next time they see him.
Yep, that's the way to do it.
And that's what I love about like the purest stand-up comedians is that they, in a way, they're sort of impervious to this whole like social media culture. You got to put your stuff. And it's like, no, you don't.
I do it, but it's more out of like, ugh.
Yeah.
Because I'm bored. I hate doing social media. I hate doing the Instagram and stuff.
Yeah.
And
it feels weird.
I don't like it, man. It's just people are like, well, how are they going to know where you are? I go, I don't know. Find me. I got to tell you everything? Get out of here.
Yeah.
And we're taking away thinking from people.
Well, not only that, but I think the idea that social media really drives engagement in the real world. Hopefully we have learned like it doesn't matter how much you live tweet a show. It doesn't matter how many times you say on social media you're going to be in a city. A tiny percentage of people be like, oh, I saw on Twitter that you know, it's usually you talk about it 100 times, you do a town, and then a day later, like, when you coming to Denver? You're like, I was just there. I didn't stop
that's
talking
my favorite.
About it.
That's exactly right. Man, huge fan. When are you coming? I was, you fucking idiot. I was just there. Oh, how come I didn't know? I thought you were a big fan, you dick.
Always good to get really aggressive with the fan.
I do get a little aggressive.
Fucking jerk. How dare you not know I was coming? How fucking dare you? Anyway, thanks for coming. You'll see you next time. We'll see you next time.
Anyway, so we'll be back in a month.
Yeah, so do you want to sign up for the email? Do you do email list at all? Do you do anything like that?
I hide out in the green room after the shows, too.
What fascinates me is that the fact that, and this I think is antithetical to sort of our modern digital culture, is that terrestrial radio does work. It does, like, I find when I go into a market, if there's a handful of tickets left and I do a morning radio show that people listen to, it moves that last chunk of tickets. Like, there's still real power in traditional media.
Maybe for you.
Yeah. No?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't like doing them because I always feel like those guys don't know who I am. Like, most of the time, my head is nobody knows who I am. That's how my world is.
Maybe that's a healthy place to come from, though.
Maybe, because in my head, it's like nobody knows who you are. So you're going to walk into these stations, they're going to stare at you, and then they're going to treat you like a jerk, and then they're going to ask you the fucking most annoying question you can ask a comic. So what can people expect from your show? Well, it's a fucking comedy show. What do you hope to expect? A lot of tears and sadness.
I'm a pioneering stand-up tragedy, and so I just tell a lot of sad stories, and everyone goes home sad.
And you know, but most people are sadistic, so they laugh at me.
Well, because there's some shows that you go on, and that they want you to, you up for bits, and it's like, it doesn't really.
You're like, I'm not trying to do funny. You should ask. I'm just
I'm just trying to like, we could talk. We could just riff.
I mean, what was it? Not funny. You should ask. It was
which one?
The other Byron Allen show.
Kicking It?
No. Oh, that's
wasn't Kicking It one?
No, there was another one before that.
Comics Unleashed.
Comics Unleashed.
Unleashed, is that it? Comics Unleashed. Yeah.
So, Chris, I hear you were just in Columbus, Ohio.
Interesting. Yes. I was, as a matter of fact. You know what I noticed about gas stations? And then it's like you somehow take a turn. But I guess it's just part of the...
It's lazy to me.
Yeah.
And I'm lazy. So if you're going to be lazy and I'm going to be lazy, we're just going to sit here staring at each other.
But you can riff, and not everyone is a riffer. And so that's sort of hard to explain sometimes. Like, we can just talk about whatever and we'll just make it fun because we're in the moment and we're having a conversation.
Yeah, they don't know how to do that. They go, we should have a talking point. No, we don't.
No, it doesn't need to.
You don't need that. You don't need that.
I can tell you from the other side of it, though, I worked on radio in the 90s, and it is... You do have to fill a lot of time, and not everyone can do what you do in a room. And so they just – it's sort of like how when you used to go on talk shows, even if you were doing a couch segment, it was almost – it was too like they're going to say this and then you say this. And it's like, oh my god, this is like an acting exercise now. This isn't like
– Yeah, you know what bothers me about that is I feel like that all turned to that in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause when you watch old Carson, it's amazing, dude. Like, guys just show up and like, be on the show. And they would just talk.
Like a podcast.
Yeah, they would just, like, Johnny made it fun. And, like, you would see they were genuinely enjoying each other. You watch Dean Martin and those guys. And when they would hang out on the roast or the Dean Martin show. Remember he had that that late night show? Where people would just drop in and hang out. And it was just fun. It was cool.
I've been down some rabbit holes, some Carson rabbit holes. And it's been really fascinating to watch, like... Richard Pryor or Carlin on.
Yeah, they weren't funny on.
They weren't funny. Like, they wouldn't really do bits per se. Like, every once in a while, they would get a laugh from the crowd, but it was just a. It was just like a. It was a fucking conversation, just like talking. And at a certain point, and probably the 80s, that shifted, and they're like, oh, let's. Everyone's got to do bits and jokes and sketches.
Yeah, let's make this better.
Right.
I've gone down the Dick Cavett rabbit hole lately.
Oh, yeah.
There's a ton of old Dick Cavett stuff popping up on YouTube.
He was really sort of the I think he was one of the godfathers of, like, the podcasting format, where he would just talk to someone.
I don't understand him, though, because I never find him funny.
He's not trying to be funny.
But he is.
But he
But it was, like, really bad. It was like.
But he was just trying to keep the ball in the air and then step out of the way.
Yeah.
He would sort of, you know, like, you know, poke at Betty Davis, get her to tell a story, and then he would back out of the way. And then occasionally be like, so you, so then you and Groucho, then, and then, like, they would start to tell a story, and then he would back out of the way. I think he was just trying to keep the ball in the air.
It was, you know, it's uncomfortable to watch him with when he would interview black people.
Really?
Yeah, it's because, you know, the thing is, he was, like, cool with them, and he was friends with them.
Yeah.
And he wasn't a racist by any means. That's not where I'm going with this. But it was that over – because of the time it was in the 80s, he would try to overly project that they're friends.
That might have been in the 60s and the 70s.
No, I watched him –
was he still doing the show in the
80s? Oh, yeah. He was going for a while, buddy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was going for a while. Like earlier – yeah, I saw with Eddie Murphy on there.
Oh, wow.
And then he would try to make like a black joke.
Really?
Because – no, but because it's like – as if you're friends, you can do that.
Oh, he was trying to establish rapport.
But he was trying to make it look like, yeah, and it would just fall flat.
Because he's Dick Cavett.
Yeah.
And it's like your dad or your granddad, and you're like, yeah, you don't need to try to do that.
Yeah. It's kind of you should watch it. It's kind of
– I will.
I'll
watch the Eddie Murphy one.
As they say, the kids nowadays, it was cringeworthy.
Well, one of the things that I've so enjoyed about Eddie Murphy's kind of like – re-emergence into the public consciousness is how much joy he seems to have. Like, he doesn't shy away at all from, like, he seems totally willing to, like, he tells these great stories about when he first became, like, one of the biggest celebrities in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He's not afraid to talk about stuff, and he seems to talk about it with, like, a real glee and nostalgia. And the fact that he is so embraces it so much delights me and makes it so fun to watch him.
Yeah, I mean, look, I got to last year I got to go to this thing. I wasn't invited, but I got to go. So Tiffany Haddish texts me. I text Tiffany a picture of my mom and her last year. And then Tiffany replied, I said, my mom loved you. She goes, oh my God, I loved your mom. She goes, guess what? I go, what? She goes, I'm on my way to Eddie's house. And I was like,
oh my
Murphy?
Gosh.
And she's like, yeah. I go, wow. I said, that's so cool. I only met him for like a second once.
Yeah.
She goes, you want to come? And I was like, are you serious? She goes, yeah, I'll come scoop you if you want to go.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm like, I was with my girlfriend and she was pregnant at the time. I'm like, we're at dinner. And I'm like, hey, babe, can I go, go, go? I'm like, oh, thank God. Because I would hate for you to be a single mother raising this kid for not letting me go see Eddie Murphy. So Tiffany picks me up and we go to Eddie Murphy's house and we walk in the house. And I'm numb with like, I can't believe this is happening. Because he was like, you know, I got Eddie Murphy stories from like 1986.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we get to his house, we go in the basement, and as we walk downstairs, the first person I see is Jamie Foxx.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, holy shit. And Jamie's like, what's up, man? I'm like, oh, hey, Jamie. And then I turn around, Eddie's like, hey, Russell, thanks for coming. I'm like, hey, Eddie Murphy knows my name.
How's he know my name?
Eddie Murphy knows my name. And then Neil Brennan's there, right? And then I hear behind me, is this what you comedians always do? You guys just hang out? And I turn around and it's Q-Tip from Tribe Called Quest.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm like, what's up, Tip? Because I know all these guys.
Yeah.
And then I look at the bar and I see Sacha Baron Cohen standing behind the bar. And then I'm like, is this a fucking movie?
By the way, this sounds like an old Bugs Bunny sketch where he walks into a club and like
everyone,
Clark Gable.
Everybody
Jimmy
was there. So Sacha Baron Cohen's behind the bar. Isla Fish is sitting at the bar. And then I see Bill Hader. Then I see Jimmy Kimmel. Then I see Patton Oswalt. Then I see Tig Notaro. Then I see Ali Wong. I see Jeff Ross. And then I hear behind me, oh, shit, man, Russell Peters. And I turn around and Chappelle's walking down the stairs. And I'm like, What the fuck have I walked into?
By the way, this sounds like the greatest open mic. Like, did just like you, the show of everyone getting up and doing 10 minutes.
Yeah. And then I'm standing there and I see this black dude with blonde hair coming downstairs and goes, "That's Cisco?" And then it was like, no, it was Chris Rock. For some reason, he had his hair dyed blonde that day.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm like, what is this? Where am I? What world am I in right now?
Everyone else must have had the same surreal experience.
Yeah. I mean, Kimmel talked about it one night. Oh, actually, matter of fact, Kimmel talked about it when Eddie Murphy was on his show.
Yeah.
And he was like talking about everybody was there, but he failed to mention me, which really bothers me to this day. That's how fucking memorable I am to him.
And what happened? Like, did you?
So then I'm just like, I went to go get a drink, and then I was like, I got a tequila, and then I go, what am I doing? I put this down. I go, I don't want to be numb. I want to remember every single part of this night.
Of course.
So I'm not saying a word to anybody because I'm just literally like gobsmacked. I'm like, I can't believe what I'm in right now.
Right.
And then I'm standing in like a doorway like this, and it's Eddie, Chris Rock, Jamie Foxx beside me, Neil Brennan, and we're standing there talking about comedy.
Oh my God.
And they're like, so when are you going to come back? And I was like, I don't know. I got like 5 minutes, man. You got to really, you know, you guys really work hard at it. And then I'm like, I'm literally not saying a word. And I'm like, I can't believe it's not like, you know, sometimes when you're standing, when people are talking and you can get the vibe that somebody's thinking, what's this guy doing here?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Do you think that's a real vibe or is that just in your head?
There's a real vibe, but that wasn't happening.
Oh.
That wasn't the vibe. I was like, that's why I stayed. I was like, this is so cool.
I always find in those situations like you – because, you know, your brain – and it's an overthinking kind of a thing where you're like, say something cool. And then there's a gap and then you say something like, comedy's my favorite. And then everyone's like, oh, cool.
That's exactly why I didn't open my mouth because I know what a fucking idiot I am and that's exactly what I would have done. You should come back and do blah, blah, blah.
Stand up is fun.
Yeah. You were so good at it.
Have you been to the Laugh Factory, Eddie Murphy?
Yeah.
Oh, gotta go.
Yeah. And so I had like a great story to tell Eddie, but I didn't tell him that either.
Yeah, sometimes it's like you're going to kick yourself either way driving home. It's either going to be because you said something stupid or because you didn't get involved and you didn't say anything at all.
Yeah.
So maybe it's like, how do you kind of... just let it go.
The cool part of this whole thing, other than everything, was like Tiffany took me there, but then Tiffany got so tired she fell asleep on Eddie's couch.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, ooh, well, I don't want to wake her up like, hey, Tiff, can you take me home?
Right.
And it's like 3:45 in the morning now. And I'm like, I didn't want to be like, hey, Eddie, can I get your address for an Uber? And then I'm like, in my head, I'm like, all these scenarios going through my head, I'm like, am I going to sleep over at Eddie Murphy's house?
Oh, my God. Eddie Murphy, do you have any pajamas I could borrow?
And I'm like, am I going to live here for the rest of my life?
Yeah.
You know, you start your brain goes mental because you're like.
I guarantee you Eddie Murphy is like, oh, I have pajamas. Like, he seems like the kind of guy that would just give you, if you needed pajamas, he'd have a set of pajamas.
I feel like he's the kind of guy that would smile and be like, hey, man, I'll see you later.
Okay.
But thank goodness Arsenio was there.
Okay.
And Arsenio goes, all right, y'all, I'm out. I go, hey, Arsenio, which way are you going, Ars? He goes, I'm going down to the valley. I go, perfect. Can I get a ride to Ventura?
Oh, great.
He goes, yeah, sure. I go, just drop me at the corner like Beverly Glen and Ventura. I'll take an Uber from there.
And then you just got the Uber from there.
And then so he takes me. We start driving. I go, here, right here, just pull over. He goes, I'm not going to leave you on the fucking corner, Beverly Glen and Ventura, like 4 in the morning. I go, well, where are you going? He goes, I'm going to Woodland Hills. I go, that's perfect. I'll go there, and then I'm a mile away from there.
Yeah.
Because I'll just take you home.
Oh, that's nice.
And I was like, wow. So Tiffany took me, and Arsenio brought me home. There's no better way to bookend that story.
But this is what's great, and it's sort of like what I was talking about with Brian Regan, too, is that comics are always comics.
Yeah.
And they're always going to want to talk about comedy, understand it, and they're all, even with like Eddie Murphy saying, like, oh, I don't know, I only got 5 minutes, they're always sort of looking over the fence like, oh, I don't know if I should do that. So I'll let you, like, there's still that sense of never feeling like you're.
We never feel complete.
You never feel complete. You never feel comfortable. You always feel like you're missing something or you don't have enough of something. And it's a bummer, but it's also charming at the same time.
It also is what keeps us moving.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I went through a whole little melancholy phase, maybe to the latter part of last year. And I started really considering leaving LA. I was like, I'm going to leave. Fuck this place. I hate it. I'm going to go. I'm going to move to fucking Texas or something.
Yeah.
I was like, I literally started looking online. I was like, looking at Nashville. I'm looking
what was it? What do you think it was?
I don't know. You just go through, you get in your head. You get in your head and then you're like, I don't know. Fuck this place. Nobody cares. Nobody's even going to notice if I leave, you know?
But you, which is funny because it, if you look at sort of the empirical data, you have this really great touring business. People do know who you are. They do come out to your shows. It is a really hard thing to convince people to put on pants and leave their house and park their cars and sit down and pay a lot of money. And, you know, like, that's a very hard – and focus. That is a really hard thing. It is hard to sell tickets.
You know what it was?
What?
I hadn't gotten back out on the road yet to start working on my new act.
Okay.
And I think I was so scared of not being able to come up with anything.
Got it.
And I was so away from it for like a couple of months.
Yeah.
That I just got in my own head. And then – and now I literally am in a place where it's like, fuck it. I don't give a shit anymore.
Right.
I don't want it. I don't care about it. I'm just loving doing stand up. It's my 31st year. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. It's fine. And it's exactly what I want to be doing. And now I guess when you change your inward energy, your outward energy changes too. So
of course it does.
And then everything that I thought was, you know, the problem is not the problem. And everybody turns out they're like, hey man, hey, I'm like, oh, okay. Things are okay, guys.
It is funny how much you're convinced of a certain reality.
Yeah.
This is totally it. And then you kind of start finding reasons without realizing it to build that case, to strengthen that case.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can. And then I started realizing that I wasn't even taking heed of my own advice. And I was always like, you know, I always tell people when you're in life, there's two roads. There's the negative road and there's positive road. Why would you take the fucking negative road?
Right.
And I started going down the negative road and I go, what's a hard road to get off of?
It is a hard road to get off of. Yeah. And you can build either, like once you start down either path, you're going to find reasons to support that no matter what.
You start laying roots down.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it is hard to get out of because you kind of have to backtrack a little bit to figure out how to get to the other one. But
yeah, and I'm one of those people that doesn't matter what it is in life. I don't like going back. I don't like negative distance.
Right. we're
motoring forward.
I left something at home. Too bad. We're not going back.
Hey, should we ask the government director? Fuck that guy.
No.
I'm not asking anybody for nothing.
Why? It's not the way things are done.
That guy's going to think I'm a bitch.
But it's important because I think in most people's lives, whatever they've convinced themselves about their reality, at least a percentage, if their perception of that were altered, would change the kind of – and you're right. It changes your outward energy because you can tell when people have inward energy.
Right.
And you can tell when people are comfortable and you can tell when people are trying too hard, which is, you know, like –
what I was also afraid of. Am I going to be out there trying too hard? Am I going to look desperate? I didn't know what the fuck I was thinking.
Yeah.
My whole team was worried about me because they were like, something's going on with that guy. And I'm like, I don't know what the fuck's going on with me. Leave me alone.
But it's just normal. I think it's a thing that everyone goes through.
I think, you know, it lets you know that you're human.
It's the life equivalent of you talk to someone at a party, you leave, you're driving home, you replay the highlight reel from the party, you go, oh my God, I made this one joke to someone. And they just split up with someone and they're going to be upset because they thought I was making fun of and this. Oh, my God. Oh, they hate me. Oh, my God. That's why. And next time you see him.
Tree.
I'm
bang.
So sorry. Then you're dead. The next time you see him or talk to him, I'm so sorry about that thing I said the last time. That was real. And they're like, what are you talking about? Like, you've built this whole case against yourself that what. Didn't
I've done
even
that with
register.
Chris Rock. I thought I said something really stupid to him. And then I thought I said something really dumb to his girlfriend. And then I was like, fuck, this guy hates my guts now.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I called Tony, his brother. I'm like, Tony, can you text your brother and tell him I apologize if I was, inappropriate that night or whatever. And he's like, what the fuck did you say to him? I go, I don't know, dude. He goes, man, my brother won't remember shit that you said to him. I go, are you serious? He goes, I promise he won't remember. And then I called like his cousin, Sherrod Small. I'm like, Sherrod, can you? And he's like, no.
He's not going
to... No, nobody. And I called Jeff Ross. I go, Jeff, can you? He goes, yeah, I'll mention it to him, pal. And I'm like, no, you're not. Nobody's going to say shit.
Yeah, but then the other thing is that you might make a thing out of it by trying to...
Yeah, I really overthought it. And I saw Chris and everything was normal.
Totally normal and fine.
Like, oh, okay.
But that's just a good lesson for, like, the stories that we tell ourselves are not, like, whatever story you tell yourself might be true because you make it true, but it doesn't necessarily make it an objective reality.
Right. Like, when I did your game show.
Yes.
And I won.
Yes.
I was sure you would remember that.
Can I tell you what happened with That Midnight? We did so many episodes of that show.
I know. But in my head, I was like, there's no way he won't remember that I won.
I've run into people that I was like, and it's more actors, not comedians, but actors like, oh my God, you know, you should do At Midnight sometime. And they go, yeah, I did it. And I had no, because you live so much in your short-term memory,
right,
that your brain just scoops out and you start over the next day.
Yep.
You know, with 600 episodes, like, I've started to go back and watch some of the hashtag games, like, oh, these were really fun. And I had literally zero memory. Like, it's like I'm watching someone else's show and a whole new thing.
Yeah, it's like when I meet, like, a celebrity that I may have, like, interviewed. I had a talk show back years ago. And I'm like, hey, how are you? And they're like, don't remember me? And I'm like, wow. And I'm like, fuck that person. They think they're cool.
That never bothers me because I do understand, like, especially a lot of times when they're in that moment, it could have been like one of five things they did that day.
Oh, shit, I know now.
Yeah. But at the time, you take it real personal.
At the time, that's a different Russell again, where you're like, I was over, you know, you get hypersensitive and to me, it's a sign of weakness. I'm like, you're not a weak guy, Russell. Why the fuck are you acting hypersensitive?
Well, not only the hypersensitive thing, but I think it's very difficult for someone who works in the creative arts where there's kind of a relatively non-linear reward system. Like, how do we know we're doing a good job? So we set up all these things that kind of feed our ego because we think, oh, well, if that's being fed, that must mean that I'm doing it. If people remember me, if people come out to my shows, if I get invited to certain parties, if I get asked to do certain things, that is a sign. But what we really just want to hear is, like, you're enough, you're complete, you're doing okay. Which, by the way, we could just accept with our present circumstances.
We look around. We should be able to look around us and go, oh yeah, we're doing good.
Yeah, we're doing good here. Yeah, I didn't have to get a job.
Where'd you grow up?
Well, I've been in LA since '88, but like I grew up in Memphis and I lived in Denver for a while and Florida.
So would you say you're a Tennessee guy?
Yes, I was born in Kentucky, but I always say I'm from Tennessee because I spent a considerable chunk of my childhood there.
I do like Tennessee.
Yeah.
I've never been to Memphis, but
Memphis is a cool town. Nashville's great.
I love Nashville.
Everyone loves Nashville. Memphis is cool. Comedy hasn't really like embraced Memphis the way some other
Neither
cities.
Has English.
Yeah. Hey there, how y'all doing? My stepmom's great. She's from Mississippi and she adds syllables to words that don't have extra syllables.
Right.
There's just like a drawl down there where everyone just sort of talks like this down there. But it's so I do consider myself Southern, but I've been in LA for, you know, 30
years.
Yeah,
I would never have guessed Southern in my life.
No. I feel a connection to it, but
because you have memories.
I have memories. Where did you grow up?
Toronto.
You grew up in Toronto.
Yeah.
Toronto's a great place for comedy too.
Especially, I started in '89, so it was right as the boom was ending.
Yeah.
So that was the best time to start because nobody cared about comedy. Nobody was paying attention to it. Make all the fucking mistakes you want in the world. Nobody's looking at you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always found that I think it was really interesting that, you know, Montreal's JFL was like, that's such a badge of honor as a new comic to go do Montreal. And I've done Montreal a bunch and I've had this experience and I've seen other comedians have this experience. There's just enough of a cultural difference that it's for a new comic. It can be very jarring, to have like an audience of Quebecois and you're doing like these American jokes that are real talky and don't have the same references or even the same cultural language. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like you can have a rough set and then a juggler gets up and fucking destroys. And goddamn. So I always found it an interesting place for new American comedians because
For Canadian comics.
Because it's its own bubble and it's a beautiful city and it's a wonderful culture, but it really is its own bubble. And if you're an outsider, you're an outsider.
The first time I did it was in '96.
Yeah.
And that was the first year they did this show called Comedy Night in Canada.
Uh-huh.
And I was, I had to fly myself in and put myself up. But I was like, it's just for laughs. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And then they put me on these Comedy Night in Canada shows. And I was the only non-white person on these shows. And they put me on first both nights. And I was so fucking mad. I was like, are you fucking kidding me, dude? You can't just bury me into the middle of the show or at the end. Like, you got to throw me on. Like, it's like, let's get rid of this one.
Oh, man.
I took it so personally. You know what I mean? I was like, because in growing up in Canada, I dealt with a lot of racism. So it was like, they're doing this shit again. They're fucking with me again.
Right. Do you think that's what was happening?
I don't even think they noticed. They were just like, I don't know, put them on there. Because my name, you're not gonna know by my name. You're going to see Russell Peters and you're like, oh, whoever that is, put that guy on first.
Right. And so was there...
It doesn't say Russell Peters Brown.
Was there an expectation about the type of comedy the audience thought you were going to do?
No, I don't know what it was. I mean, I did okay.
Yeah.
I by no means did great. And Mike McDonald was hosting.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, how you feeling, kid? Backstage. And I go, I'm really nervous. So, I'm pretty nervous. And then he goes, well, what do you want me to say about you? I go, I know, except from Toronto, I guess. I don't know. And then he goes, first comic backstage. Hey, really nervous. I'm like, fucker.
Maybe it's better that maybe if he had said you were from Toronto, maybe the crowd would have turned on you.
Yeah, but, you know, I was just, you know, if you're not in this business, I don't know if you came around this or if you're the only one in your family in this business.
Yeah, I am.
It's the same. You don't know what to do.
Right.
You don't know how to act. You don't know how to. I'm still meandering my way through this fucking business.
Sure, but ultimately I feel like the thing that we arrive at is when you can peel back all the layers and just be the most comfortable version of you, that's when the magic happens. But fuck, that's really hard to get to that place.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And like you got like the people like Brad Pitt. Nobody in his family's in the business, but you know he's beautiful,
right?
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, he's
just, yeah. It's, you know, and you got a lot of these people that they're just really pretty people. So being a beautiful human being physically is like being famous your entire life. People treat you differently.
So what? So because I feel like there's a lot of different identities at play because you have the cultural background that like your ancestry, mm-hmm. but then your Canadian cultural background, mm-hmm. but then also like a connection to America versus like also performing in Montreal and having that. So like, where do you? Did you eventually just sort of feel like, you know what, I'm me and I'm all of these things,
yeah,
and none of these things at
the same
time?
That's where I am at now. And like, I think that's why Canada is so loyal to me, because I always, number one, I always say I'm Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, I always, it's at a point now where when I go to events in LA or at, you know, Hollywood party type of thing, people are like, hey, Russell, how long are you in town for? I go, oh, you know, 14 years now, you fuck. What do you mean, how long am I in town for? Been here a long time.
I feel like one of the angriest kind of threads from a joke that I saw was I was doing Fallon a few years ago, and I mentioned that I was going to go to Just for Laughs, and I said, I'm going to Montreal, or as I call it, Practice France. And I just thought, like, oh, it was a stupid throwaway joke. And got really mad. Like, they got
people get mad over anything. Yeah, like
the comments in the thread, I had posted it somewhere, and they were like, well, America sucks for this. And I was like, I'm not saying anyone sucks. I'm sorry. I wasn't trying
to. Who used to say Canada, we're America's hat?
Oh, God. Who was that?
I don't remember.
That sounds familiar, but I can't remember who
Canada,
that was.
Canada, we're America's hat.
But I do find comedy in Canada to be a wonderful experience. And it's Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, Edmonton. Yeah. Like, there's so many great places to perform there. And I find the crowds to be engaged and warm and welcoming.
Because
and
you're
fun.
Famous to them now.
Oh, is that really?
Yeah, try coming up in that.
Okay.
Oh, it's a bummer, buddy.
Was it really?
That's why you get good comics out of Canada, because the audiences are difficult.
Yeah.
They do not want to laugh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They literally have a mentality, make me fucking laugh, boy.
So it is a little bit of a battle.
Yeah, they're like, make me laugh. And they pride themselves on being miserable in that respect.
But isn't that kind of a gift in a way when you're coming up? Because if you can figure out how to navigate that.
Well, that's what makes the great comics, because we know how to cut through that bullshit. And then once you crack the code, you don't get that anymore from them.
Right.
You know what I mean? Once you figure out, oh, I know, I understand that. That's what you're trying to do, but here's what I'm going to do for that.
Right, right, right.
And then it goes away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But when you're a new comic, that's what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
When you're coming up, you're like, ugh, make me laugh, boy.
And so with the first time you went to Montreal, what happened? Like, did it lead to – because that
was – led to nothing.
Okay.
It led to me being in debt for the flight, the hotel. me thinking, you know, and it was 96. That's when they were giving out deals left,
like,
right,
left and right. Yeah, so you're like, I'm going, like, to Montreal.
I'm
going to
get a deal.
Yeah.
And I – dude, I had – oh, my God. I said the dumbest things to people trying to be clever. I had no clue.
Do you think that – this sort of like the blessing and the curse of the comedian is the overactive kind of like if we didn't overanalyze everything, do you think we would sort of lose the comedy power?
We would lose something because.
But it turns on you too. It turns on yourself.
You know what it is? We're still the same kid that was like, hey, you're not allowed to say that, okay?
Yeah.
And you're like, but why not? I'm going to say it and watch. Nothing's going to happen.
Right.
And then in my head, I was like, that's probably – say that. And I'm like, the fuck made you say that?
But do you feel that power of – like, do you get more control over it as you get older where you
– Well, yeah. I mean, again, you go through these you're a snake. You're always shedding your skin.
Yeah.
So you eventually figure out listen, we don't really fully – nobody really fully figures out this entertainment business until we're right on our deathbed. And then we're like, oh,
shit. Can I just have 10 more years?
Yeah. Just give me 5 more minutes. Don't give me the light yet.
Just give me 5 more minutes. Oh, my God. Yes, you're literally running the light that you're supposed to walk through. I'm getting the light. Yep. I'm just going to close with this.
Yeah. This didn't go the way I planned.
So when you said, you know, you went through this period of depression, this dark period, you didn't know what you were going to say, which is so funny because – you know, you had like 8 other specials, I imagine, that proved that, yeah, I keep finding stuff to say. And you also know that you can riff. How much did you have when you went on stage at that point?
I start with zero.
You start with zero and you
literally
start
with zero. And it's because I don't really know what direction I'm going in. I don't know what I want to talk about until I get up there.
And you think that's your body trying to process and purge whatever sort of stuff.
No,
that's
my brain going, thinking too much. Then you get on, you just do it.
Right.
It's like, oh my God, I can't swim. I can't swim. Oh, you get in the pool. Oh, I'm okay. I'm good. Treading.
Yeah.
I'm good. Sorry, guys. Sorry about the panic.
As much as I riff on stage, I've had those shows where I go, you know what? I'm just going to go up with nothing and then just kind of see if I can bail myself out. And usually the answer is no. Like, I need a base of material to at least be able to go back to when the riffing stuff isn't working, but just to go up on stage with nothing and just kind of see what pans out, like, that is not.
I mean, it trips me out and scares me, and honestly, it freaks me out, but I don't think I could do it. And I want to. Like, when you say how you sit down and you write and on your laptop, I'm like, I envy that ability to focus like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why if you have kids, you throw your laptop out the window because
they will.
It's not going to work.
Yeah. And what was for you, what was different about this special? Did it feel different? Like, were you like, oh, I think I'm really like, because I just think of us as these like blocks of marble that we're just constantly chiseling and chiseling and chiseling and chiseling away at until it becomes this very kind of detailed thing.
I like this new special, but I've seen a lot of people who hated it online.
Oh.
I've seen people hate it or love it. I haven't seen anybody going, eh, it's all right.
So is that good then? Because it's not – because if something's polarizing, is that better than it just like people going meh?
Yeah. I mean, it's better than meh.
Right.
You know what I mean? Ultimately. But obviously the haters are louder than the
– Sure.
Than the people that enjoy it.
Sure.
You know, the manager usually hears about the complaints, not the compliments.
So – and how has – just because as we are emerging in all these different platforms, Amazon, which the special is on, versus like – it's like I don't even know in 3 years like what the comedy platforms are going to be. Is it going to be Amazon, Netflix, and HBO, or is like someone else going to like? I don't even know.
I like to think of myself as a pioneer, and I've got an idea for the next one.
You do.
I got an idea for where it's going to go, and I'm working on it from now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it like a different, completely a new platform?
It's not a new platform, but it's a new way of doing it.
Okay.
Yeah. So it cuts out something. I don't want to say too much.
No, you don't have to say too much. But just from someone who you said sort of got your start because in the earliest days of YouTube, that was a whole new thing of realizing, oh, these things that we're putting on the internet are not regional. This is the Earth's internet.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even put it on there.
Someone else did.
Yeah, because I'm still completely computer illiterate to this day.
But
that's why when you say you write on your computer, I'm like, how do you do that? Like,
just a series
like I would literally just be sending, I'd have to send emails to somebody in order to figure out how to send something and save it. That would be like, hey, Chris. And I would just, hey, Chris, ignore this email. This is just me writing my act. And then I would type, and I would have to send it to you just so I don't lose it.
In the 22 years that I've been doing stand-up, it's only been the last few that I've done computers. Like, before, it was just I had notebooks.
Yeah.
But then it just started, like, the cross-referencing and the, oh, where was that? And flipping pages and then having to bring a notebook around
right.
and being terrified to lose it. And, you know, I finally just turned it over to digital and I just got used to it.
Yeah.
It's not what I would prefer to do, but it just is easier.
Does it feel like you're not as connected to it when you're doing it through the computer?
No, because my brain has just found a way to connect with it in a way that I can.
Yeah, I mean, you relearn how to.
Yeah. Well, and I also, I create file history.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, I'll type out, you know, like jokes that I want to do for, you know, the Thursday night in a show. And then on the Friday, I'll go through and make edits and change stuff. And then I'll save that as that file for that date.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I have a file history of that really kind of walks through the evolution. So,
see, I don't even know how to do that. I literally do not. Like, when I used to write out my act very early in my career, I would write it out literally. If I said I would write
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, I wish I really had those notes still. I would love to find those notes.
Well, it's just sort of the you know, there are guys, like, I need to write stuff down to remember them, but there are the Chappelles of the world who are just like, I've never written anything down.
Yeah.
It just all – and I've seen him over a week. I was at the Punchline once, and he was also there, and so – He just kept headlining, and I opened for him for a series of shows like 10 years ago, and I watched him start with this kind of blob of a conversation
mm-hmm.
that was still funny, but then over the next like 3 days, just watch it get whittled into this fucking sculpture of a
yeah.
piece, and he never wrote any of it down. He just remembered it,
yeah.
And that and it was we're talking about like 3 hour sets,
yeah.
And somehow that's just how his brain works, and I was so in awe of it because mine. Doesn't I was like I would have to be like, wait, what did I say yesterday? Oh, I wrote it down. Okay, great.
Yeah, like I have my assistant watching me and be like, hey, the way you did it tonight was the way to do it, you know,
which is helpful.
Yeah,
because in a way that's...
But the idiot will text me while I'm on stage. Do you know what I mean? Like my phone's right there and I keep it face down like this, but I, you know, I'll just sometimes flip it over to check the time and I'll see my agent, my my assistant text me, go, oh, something wrong, and I'm like, are we okay? Sorry guys, I'm a fucking idiot. While I'm on stage, you text me this?
But you put in airplane mode.
Yeah. Don't get smart with me, kid.
I'm sorry. That was out of line. I was way out of
I don't,
line.
I don't need your logical
okay,
answers.
I'm so
to,
sorry. No, you're absolutely
to dumb,
right. I
dumb,
apologize.
I don't need your logical solutions to dumb problems.
So now that the special is out, did you stop doing all those jokes second
done.
The special came out?
I kind of stopped doing them. The second I recorded it.
Yeah.
Well, I still had some dates left, so I kept it for that. But I was like, I was prepared to let it go right away.
And so are you already like way into the next one by now? You must be because...
Listen, I started January 2nd.
Right.
With going up with nothing. And now
yeah.
What are we at?
Almost February, mid-February.
Mid-February. And I think I've got about 20 minutes now.
That's great.
And as far as I'm concerned, that's a pretty good fucking amount of time to have in a month.
So do you – is the idea – what's your turnaround? Like is it
– I have to be ready by June.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
You're already shooting another special?
No. I mean ready to tour.
Oh, gotcha. So yeah. But what's the turnaround for – do you do a special – if you've done 9 specials, you must do a special about every year or two.
No, I've been doing them every 3.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'm like – I don't see the purpose of doing them every 2 years. The material, it doesn't benefit the material.
Because you have to live with it for a long time to find
yeah.
the real – right.
Yeah. And I always think back to like my best specials were like when I had a little bit more time.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's go back. There's no rush. There's enough specials out there to fill the space in the meantime. Probably better specials even.
Is your plan to – do you think you'll be a guy that just does specials until like your last breath?
I don't think I want to do any more specials, but I'm going to do a 10th.
Yep.
And then
it's
we'll
10.
See.
You got to do 10.
Yeah, we'll hit the nice even 10 mark, and then we'll just see what happens. I mean, but I always say these things, and then, you know, there'll be an 11th. Then there'll be a fucking 12. You know, right. Whatever there'll be. Bob Newhart told me a long time ago that what we have is a gift, and that we have to share the gift. Mm-hmm. It would be completely selfish of us to not share this gift with the world. And he said, there's no due date on this. You share it until you die.
I loved the way that it was the first time that I had heard like a legend. This is many, 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 many years ago. I wrote an article for Wired and I talked to a bunch of different comedians like him and Stephen Wright. This is like before podcasts, even before I did a podcast. So maybe it was even 15 years ago, and just sort of talking to them about their process. And to hear this legendary comic that he would, because he does these long act out pieces. And So I would build in a bailout point, several bailout points. And if I could get to that bailout point and people were still engaged, I would go to the next bailout point. But if I started to lose people, then I would just bail out. So he essentially would write like 5 or 6 endings for every bit. And depending on how in the audience was, he could just get out at the perfect moment.
Wow.
I don't write that way, but I...
He's like got a really brilliant mind and knows how to economize words perfectly.
Yeah.
So 10 years ago, I was lucky enough for him to choose me out of everybody. He chose me to be the representative for the younger generation of comics and be there for him at his induction for the 50 years in film and television. Mm-hmm. And I was like so taken aback and honored. And then so he has this private dinner after and I get invited. And it's like me and I'm sitting at a table with Peter Scolaro.
Oh, Peter Scolari. I know Peter. Peter's great.
From
Bosom Buddies.
Yes. And Fred Willard. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, this is so, and Don Rickles is there, and Don was one of my idols.
Yeah.
And so Bob gets up to tell a story. And there's this woman there. I won't say who she was. She was the wife of a very well-to-do TV producer. Mm-hmm. And she was drunk and kind of obnoxious. So Bob's he's like, I want to thank everybody. I want to tell you a quick story. And then she's like, is this going to be funny, Bob? Oh, Bob, is this going to be a funny story?
No.
Is this going to be funny? And then everyone's like, the fuck? And then Bob just goes, why don't we all find out together? And I was like, that's fucking perfect.
It must have killed.
It destroyed. And I'm like, it was perfect.
Like, see? He took a flaw and made it like it's sort of that's what I love about comedy is like spinning gold out of the flaws, like spinning magic out of the flaws.
Like
and,
I would have been like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah, but he needed that moment to happen in order to engage the audience, pull them in, have like this amazing experience. And if it hadn't happened, you wouldn't have remembered that moment. Right. So in a way, that's sort of the beauty part about being able to be in the moment like that is that those imperfect moments become like the magical parts.
It's how we save them.
Is Jay Mandiam opening for you some on the road?
Yeah, this weekend.
I love Jay. He's such a sweet guy.
In
he's
Houston.
Really funny. He's a good guy.
He's a good kid.
Yeah, he really is.
He's worked hard.
He has, and I met him at the Comedy Store, and he did At Midnight, and he had an amazing first time he was on the show. He had an amazing first show. It was really great. I'm glad you're touring with him.
He's a good kid.
Is there anything else you want to promote while you're here? Deported.
Deported. No, that's over. That's the special now.
That's the special.
So you can watch that on Amazon Prime Video. And I will be coming to a town near you soon.
Yeah. By the way,
I'm in Grand Rapids coming up.
Grand Rapids is a fun comedy town.
It's like Gilda Radner Comedy Fest.
Yeah. Like Gilda's Laugh Fest. It's a fucking...
Have you done it?
I have. It's great.
I'm doing that on, I think, March 8th or something.
Oh, you'll love it.
Let me confirm the date.
It is a
March 8th. It is.
It is a good festival and a good town for comedy. I think you'll actually love it. And I just wanted to Deported is the name of your special, not a thing I was just saying.
Right. I think Chris Hardwick is suggesting that I get deported.
I don't think that's what I was.
I'm
not 100%
put away
sure.
That white pointy
I
hat,
don't
Mister.
Have a hat on. That
I
is
get
either
it. You're from Memphis.
Stop it.
No, I will not build a wall.
Don't use Tennessee against me. Russell, I can't thank you enough for being
here. Thanks, buddy. I appreciate it.
It's always so good to see you. And one of those, it's one of my favorite things about the you know, always going to Montreal. It's like the shows are fun, but it's just like
it's the hang that I love
the
most.
It's going to that one hotel with the round bar.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
That everyone
the Hyatt.
After their shows just like gets ready. Like, oh my god, it's like a you know.
It's great. And then you want to talk to people, but then you get distracted so quick.
Yeah.
Hey, man. Oh, hey, sorry. Hey, man.
And then they disappear.
Everybody fucks off on each other.
Yeah.
But nobody takes it personal.
Nobody's like, hey,
you didn't come back.
No, not at all. Not at all.
It's nice. It's fun to be around everybody.
Well, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. This castle is wonderful.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that.
I really want to see more of it.
Yeah, I'll show you around.
Yeah.
We got to put some secret doors. We need the secret doors.
This feels like a secret room.
This was a secret room. This wasn't a room. This was a... We put the walls up, but it's concrete under here. It was just like a... There was a patio above here, so this was just like underneath the patio, and so we punched through and made this the podcast room.
This is great.
It's our little podcast bomb shelter.
Cool. I mean,
this is from Meltdown Comics. I don't know if you ever performed at Meltdown.
No, that was your thing.
It was, well, Joan and Kumail did their thing there, and then we built like we programmed the other nights of the week, but they started it like they started doing comedy there on Wednesday nights, and so. It was just like, oh, why isn't there comedy here 7 nights a week?
That was Nerd Melt?
That was, yes.
And that's gone now, right?
Yeah, Meltdown he got rid of it. Gaston, it closed. It's not, it's
now he's gassed off.
Hey!
Hello.
We did it. We started with a pun.
That's right.
And we landed with a pun.
That's right. You know my favorite rapper was Big Pun. All right, guys.
Hey, guys, come on. It's fun. Good night. Good night.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito. Thank you.